coming up, Steve.
Good to be here this morning. If you take your Bibles and turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. While you're turning there, as mentioned, I'm the registrar at Crown College. And by the way, I also need some water. Brought me a big jug. I'm kidded at college for carrying that thing around with me everywhere I go. Excuse me for not standing before when you sang, but I have trouble standing. I'm on the verge of back surgery, and I'm just recovering from double hernia surgery that I had over Christmas break, and I still have some swelling from that. So standing is not something that comes real easily to me. Fortunately, my wife's a nurse and helped me recuperate, but I worked 20 weeks, the week is 20 hours, the week of surgery, 50 hours the next week, 60 hours the next week, and so that didn't help recovery any in working at that. But it's good to be here. I'm teaching 7 classes at Crown College this year, in addition to my job as registrar. I've taught college for 18 years. This is my second year at Crown. I moved here from Iowa, most recently from Oskaloosa, Iowa. So up to the frozen tundra. At least we haven't had so much snow as I was led to fear. But anyway, it is good to be with you here this morning. I assume you've found 1 Corinthians 13 by now. And for those of you who are familiar with Corinthians, perhaps at times the question mark has run across your mind. What is chapter 13 doing where it's at? Has that question ever occurred to anyone? You know what comes before it? Chapter 12, Paul's talking about spiritual gifts. Chapter 14, right after it, Paul's talking about spiritual gifts. And right smack dab in the middle is this what we call the love chapter. So what's it doing there? I mean, there's a logical flow to this book, and so why is he putting it there? And so we'll think about that this morning. As a matter of fact, when we look at the very last part, the last verse in chapter 12, he says, "And now I will show you the most excellent way, and that's the way of love." His point is, see, the Corinthian church is all agog about gifts, especially the flashy gifts, speaking in tongues and healing and prophecy and stuff like that. And everybody is saying, "I'm better than you are because I got this gift," kind of thing. And Paul spends his time in chapters 12 and chapters 14 saying, "You got it all wrong. Having a certain gift doesn't make you any better than anybody else. God needs everybody, regardless of what gift you do or don't have. But there is one gift that is available to everybody. And that gift is better than all the other gifts. And that gift is love." And that's what he talks about in 1 Corinthians 13. Let us read it together this morning. "If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have faith that can move mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor, surrender my body to the flames, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. Whether our prophecies, they'll cease. Whether our tongues, they'll be stilled. Whether it's knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when perfection comes, the imperfect disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. But when I became a man, I put childish ways behind me. Now we see but a poor reflection, then we will see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. A bunch of boys are playing softball in the backyard, a couple of them. On one team, the first baseman is a 13-year-old, pretty athletic, extremely competitive, and because of that, or whatever sport he's at, his team usually wins because he's more competitive than anybody else. His brother, who's a year and a half younger than him, is playing shortstop. The batter hits the ball to his brother, the shortstop, who picks it up and throws it to the first baseman, who jumps high in the air, but the ball sails over his head. His brother has blown it again. He slams his glove to the ground. He starts menacingly walking toward his brother, screaming, "You stupid idiot! I ought to smash your face. Can't you do anything right? You're going to pay for this." About that time, the back door opens. Dad steps out on the back steps and says, "Son, come over here. Oh, and bring your glove with you." "Why, what have I done? I didn't do anything." "Bring your glove and come." And so he slowly walks toward the house, growling once more at his brother, threatening him, "You haven't heard the last of this. You're going to pay for this." As he goes inside the house. Oh, by the way, his dad's a minister. This is in the good old days. So he went to Sunday school, worship service, Sunday night service, Wednesday night service, every single week of his life for 13 weeks, and now he's in a youth group as well. He started reading the Bible when he was 8 years old. He read the Bible all the way through, and he's 8 years old, and so by this time he's read the entire Bible through 6 times. His dad marches him up to the room that he shares with his brother for him to get his whipping with this big honking belt. But first, he's got to read him the Riot Act. And he tells him how upset God is with how he's behaving and how much he has hurt Jesus by how he's acting and treating his brother. And remember that Jesus died on the cross for your sins and paid the penalty. Here you are treating him this way. And all the time, the 13-year-old boy is thinking, yada, yada, yada. I mean, I know this. I've heard this a million times. I can say it better than you can. Just get it over with and whip me. That's what's going through his mind. Then his dad does something strange. His dad takes off his shirt, gets out the big belt, hands it to his 13-year-old son, and he says, "This time, you're going to whip me. Just like Jesus paid the penalty for your sins, I'm going to take your punishment." Now let me tell you, there was more than one occasion when this 13-year-old boy had dreamed about this, wailing on Dad, letting him have it. But this was not one of those times, because Dad had got to him. And all of a sudden he says, "I'm not going to do this. There's no way I'm going to whip you." But his father says, "We're not leaving this room until you whip me. You have to hit me as hard as you can on my bare back with this huge belt 10 times. The son finally realizes that his dad means it, so he takes the belt and hits him. After 3 times, Dad stops him. He says, "I know you can hit a lot harder than that. That doesn't count." The boy is crying. He's in tears by this point. He didn't want to do this. And so he has to hit his dad hard. Now, to be honest, he doesn't hit him as hard as he can, because when this boy loses his temper, he's incredibly strong. But he has to hit him hard enough that his dad thinks he is, and he raises welts on his dad's back. This is a true story on that 13-year-old boy. And that was my dad who did that for me. That's love in action. That's the kind of love that the Apostle Paul is talking about here in 1 Corinthians 13. You know, it's easy to say that we love, especially around Valentine's Day, which is coming up. But it's another thing to put our love into practice. And so as we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 13, we'll look at some characteristics of what love is really all about and kind of hold up the mirror to ourselves and look at ourselves and ask, how are we doing? Anything we need to work on? My guess is the answer is yes. I know for me the answer is yes. And my guess is it is for you too. In the first part of the chapter, Paul seeks to convince his audience of the importance of love. Remember, they're all hung up on these gifts. Whether or not who's speaking in tongues and how much he speaks in tongues, or who has the gift of prophecy, or who has the gift of interpretation of tongues, the gift of healing, you know, the flashy things, you know. So Paul has to persuade them that those things aren't so important. What really is important is love. And so he starts off with a bunch of, if I can do this, but don't have love, what's it get me? And so if I am the greatest communicator in world history, if I make Billy Graham in his prime look like nothing, look like a has-been, look like a wannabe, but if I don't have love, I may be a great communicator. People may even be led to the Lord because of my preaching, but me personally, my relationship with God ain't worth squat if I don't have love. By the way, if I don't have love, I probably won't be that effective leading others to the Lord either, because they'll probably see through me. If I have great predictive ability, he says, so I can predict all kinds of things. Wouldn't it be nice if I could predict for President Bush where Saddam Hussein did and did not have various biological weapens, stuff to make nuclear weapons, etc., and I keep playing this shell game of hiding stuff, and if I could tell him exactly where things were, exactly where he was going to move them, or exactly where Osama bin Laden is, if he's still alive, and the other leaders of Al-Qaeda, and exactly what they're up to, and when they're going to do it, wouldn't that be great? If I could predict all sorts of stuff, if I could tell you what was going to happen in all your lives. Now, you might not want to know that, by the way. Sometimes we're better off finding out one day at a time rather than knowing. Because sometimes if we knew what was in store for us, we'd freak out. But God helps us when it comes there. But anyway, if I had that kind of predictive ability, but if I didn't love, spiritually, it's worthless to me. I could even be the most intelligent, the most brilliant man in the world. I could make Albert Einstein look like an idiot. Or today we might say Stephen Hawking, great physicist, philosopher, who himself, in a sense, is an idiot because he doesn't believe in God, despite all his great brilliance. But anyway, if I was the smartest person in the world, I had all this knowledge, and by the way, I could be the greatest theologian in the world, too, and have all the answers to everything in the Bible, and exactly explain how everything fits together more logically, more persuasively than anybody in human history, but if I don't have love, it profits me nothing in my relationship with God. I could have great faith. I could be a great miracle worker, make Oral Roberts look like nothing. When I heal them, they stay healed. And I heal them, they always get healed, not just part of the time. But if I don't have love, so those people that get healed may benefit, but me and my relationship with God, once again, nothing. Even if I go so far as to give my own life on behalf of somebody else, maybe somebody's been sentenced to death and I manage to somehow take their place. For those of you who read Tale of Two Cities back in the good old days, you remember that's what happens in that book. Somebody does that for somebody else. But even if I give my life for somebody else, but I don't have love, because I might be doing it for selfish motives, you see. Maybe I'm doing it to earn favor with God. If I don't do it based on love, it's worthless in God's eyes. Saves that guy's life, or that woman's life that I gave my life for, but as far as my relationship with God, it doesn't amount to a hill of beans. The bottom line is, doesn't matter what you do, how great you perform, you can be the most perfect human being outwardly that has ever existed, but without love, in God's eyes, you're nothing. Okay, so now that we've established the necessity of love, that we need love, or else, let's find out what love is. Don't you just love it where he starts with? The very first thing is love is patient. Why couldn't he have picked somewhere else to start and shoved that one somewhere in the middle where it's not so obvious? If I don't know about you, but that's one that I struggle with sometimes. Being patient. And over the years, I've become more and more patient. I'm patient with my staff. For the most part, I'm patient with students. But when it comes to my family, I'm not always quite so patient. You know what I mean? Yep. Some of you have been there too. But love, he says, that's where he starts off with, love is patient. And so that's a good one for all of us to work on. It's not only patient, love is kind. It's considerate. It's gentle. Love. It's always thinking about the other person and always going out of their way not to hurt them in any way, but rather to help them, to uphold them, to build them up. Love doesn't envy. Love doesn't say, well, I should have been elected to the board instead of him. I should be on the worship team instead of her. I should have been asked to teach Sunday school. After all, I've been around longer. I know the Bible better. I'm more spiritually mature. Love doesn't say, I should have gotten that promotion at work. By the way, sometimes those things are true. That maybe you should have gotten that place, or you were more qualified than that person who got asked to do that, whether it's in the church, whether it's at work, or wherever. But love doesn't go there. Love is not envious of others, but rather love rejoices when others get accolades, get praise, get awards, instead of saying, it should have been me. Love doesn't envy. On the flip side, love doesn't boast. Love doesn't say, I got elected to the board. Those people must think I'm pretty important. I'm Mr. Spiritual. Oh, and by the way, I happen to be the most humble person in the world. Obviously, if I say that, I'm not, am I? But some of the things that we can say in boasting at times. Love doesn't boast, doesn't brag. It's easy to do that. Love doesn't behave improperly. In the NIV, which I read to you, it says rude. It's not rude. The word in the Greek says love doesn't behave improperly. And so it can have a variety of specific meanings as far as what it's talking about there. But love, and not being rude, means it has respect for authority, even when they don't know what they're doing. Because sometimes they don't, by the way. But think of King David. Think of David before he's king, when Saul is king, and David has already been anointed to be the king. So he knows he's supposed to be the king, and he knows that God has rejected Saul. But yet David shows respect for Saul, even though Saul's trying to kill him, by the way. Saul spends like a dozen years trying to kill David rather than doing his job as king. But despite the fact that Saul is a worthless king, a murderous king, who is trying to kill David, David shows respect for him and refuses to kill him even when he's given two golden opportunities. He says, that's not my job, that's God's. So love shows respect for those in authority. It doesn't act in a dishonorable or disgraceful way. Love isn't self-seeking. It doesn't put personal pleasure ahead of God's work or ahead of other people. Remember the little chorus, Jesus, others than you? A lot of truth in that children's chorus. That's what our priority should be. God first, then others, than us. Typically, it's us first, then maybe God, then others. Let's be honest. That's how things tend to be if we're not careful. And so we need to not be self-seeking, but put others first. And never seek pleasure at the expense of others, but rather sacrifice ourselves at times for the good of others. Love doesn't get irritable either. It's not easily angered. By the way, if you're impatient, you probably get irritable easily. So those will be my two biggest ones, probably, for me personally. And again, it's with the family that it's the easiest for that to happen. I can avoid it elsewhere, but sometimes with the family, that comes out. And here's another good one. Love doesn't keep record of wrongs. Now think about that. Sometimes when somebody has wronged you, and then you have forgiven them or asked, maybe they've asked for forgiveness and you've forgiven them, and then sometime later, you have a conflict with them and you say, remember when you, and you throw it back in their face. That means you're keeping score. You're keeping record of wrongs when you do that. And he says, true love doesn't do that. True love doesn't keep score. I know some people who literally keep score and write them down to make sure they don't forget what kinds of wrongs and slights that have been done to them. But whether you write it down, a piece of paper, or write it down in your memory, love doesn't do that, he says. Love doesn't throw those things back in other people's faces at some time. It's not judgmental. Love doesn't delight in evil. Now, remember, he's talking to Christians. So in light of that fact, ask yourself, what does he mean when he says love doesn't delight in evil? Obviously, these Corinthian Christians are not going to delight in murder and rape and pornography and those kind of stuff, are they? So what kind of evil might these Christians, might these church members delight themselves in? Well, if you're familiar with the book of Corinthians, you know that there are a lot of cliques, a lot of factions in the church at Corinth. These people have their own group over here, and they don't want to associate with these group. Even when they have church meals, they do that. And so there's a lot of friction within the church. And so somebody in this group sees somebody in that group over there that they don't like, and see them doing something wrong, they say, all right, we got them. Or see them suffer in some way. All right, they got what's coming to them. And so let me give you a personal example so you can think about yourself. This is my second year at Crown College. I'd been at another Bible college for 10 years and was off a year in between. I got fired at the other college. Because I refused to lie. I was the academic dean there for 3 years. And some people in positions of leadership, from my perspective, were not Christian, despite the fact that this was at a Holiness Bible College. And I wouldn't go along with what they demanded. One of those people is dying of cancer right now. He's a year and a half older than I am. And so if I'm going to love, I'm not going to say, all right, he's got what's coming to him because he betrayed me, pretended to be my friend and stabbed me in the back. And that's what he did. But rather love says, reaches out in love to Charles and his family and prays for them and seeks God's best for them rather than saying, all right, that's what's coming to him. Because that's not love. So think about that in your own situation. We've all been wronged by people. I don't have to know you to know that. I just know human nature. Somebody has wronged you. More than one somebody, most likely. And so when something bad happens to them, how do you react? Love doesn't rejoice in that, but rather is sorrowful and is prayerful for them rather than vindictive. And I think that's what he has in mind in light of the situation in Corinth. Love rejoices in the truth. Then he has this series of always. So we don't get to do it some of the time when we feel like it, but we're supposed to always be that way. Love always bears or always endures. It keeps confidential others' wrongs. It endures abuse from others. Love always trusts. In other words, when somebody says or does something, oftentimes there are a multitude of ways that you can interpret that. You can interpret it in a very negative way, and people with a critical spirit typically do that. You can interpret that in a positive way. Love chooses to interpret it in a positive way and trust. Now, by the way, sometimes you get burnt that way. Back to my situation, back at the school in Iowa, I had a friend who told me for a whole year, the president's out to get you, he's stabbing you in the back, and I refused to believe him. And the guy happened to be right, by the way. But still, if I had to go back and do it over again, I think I would choose to go the same way, to believe in the man and to trust him rather than to be suspicious of people all the time. Because that's what love does. By the way, sometimes love gets hurt. Love gets you betrayed. Well, that happened to Christ. It happened to all the apostles, so why shouldn't it happen to us? But love thinks the best of others. It always trusts rather than thinks the worst of them. It generates confidence in others. One of the things I try to do with my students is tell them I believe in you. You can do things. I just got a letter from an elderly gentleman in a church I used to pastor in Iowa. Now they have a student pastor from the college that I got fired from, who told them the only reason he's there today is because I believed in him when nobody else there did. And I felt good to hear that. But that's what love does. Love believes in people that other people write off. I don't like to write people off. I always think there's hope. Which brings us to the next always. Love always hopes. I have a brother. Remember the brother that I beat up all the time? He's a year and a half younger than me. 6 kids in my family. He's number 3. I'm number 2 because I have an older sister. As you already have heard, I was not a model child growing up. My brother John was. Of the first 5, they were for 1.5 years or something, there were 5 teenagers in my family at the same time. Pity my poor mom. But John was the perfect child, never got himself in trouble, was a straight-A student, valedictorian from the top high school in the state of Iowa, in Iowa City. Perfect kid. On graduation day from high school, he told my parents, "Oh, by the way, I've been faking it all these years. I don't believe in the existence of God." That was 29 years ago. My mom prays for him every day, and my mom is absolutely convinced that he's going to come to the Lord. Love always hopes. And I've seen an example of that. When I was a youngster living out in western Nebraska at a church that my dad pastored out in Sandhills, an elderly couple in the church who came to church regularly. She was a Christian. He was not. He was 84 years old. And she prayed for him every day. And one Sunday night, when he was 84 years old, he came to the altar and gave his heart to the Lord. She'd been praying for him for 60 years. She never gave up, and she saw the answer to her prayer. And by the way, ironically, he died of a heart attack 2 weeks later. But love always hopes, and love always perseveres, sticks with it, even if it takes 60 years like it did in the case of Grandma French, who kept sticking with it, kept believing, kept praying, until finally her prayer was answered. So love endures. Whether it's enduring and praying for someone or enduring an opposition that we face at times, when you know God's called you to something, stick with it, no matter what other people say, as long as you're positive that it's God that's in it. Paul goes on to say, love never fails. Now, people fail, but love never fails. Then he goes on to contrast love with those other gifts, and that's what he's doing in the last part of the chapter. He says, you know, prophecy and tongues and all that stuff, they don't last. The only one that lasts is love. Then he says, when I was a child, I spoke as a child, I thought as a child, etc. What he's talking about there is when I was a spiritual child, because he is earlier in the book called the Corinthians spiritual babies. He says, you've been Christians for a long time, but you're still spiritual babies. He tells them about back in chapters 2 and 3. He says, it's time to grow up, folks. He says, when I was a spiritual baby, I thought those flashy gifts, basically is what he's saying, were where it was at. But as I matured, I put away childish things. Now, Paul tells us elsewhere that he spoke in tongues more than anybody. It's not that he couldn't do it. He says, it's not important. He says, what is important is what I'm going to focus on, and that's love. He says, now these three abide, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. As we conclude this morning, I'd like to challenge you. Remember, we were supposed to hold the mirror up? How's it look? We covered a lot of characteristics, didn't we? I'm willing to guess that none of you scored 100. I don't have to know you to guess that. I just have to know human nature. I didn't score 100 either. I already identified a couple for me. So what I would challenge you to do, by the way, some of you might say, oh, I didn't do, I'm weak there. I may as well give up. Well, if you feel that way, don't. Pick one or two areas. By the way, ask God to help you make your choice. It's always a good idea to ask Him for His guidance. Pick one or two areas and ask yourself, what can I do to improve in those areas? And always remember, it's not simply what can I do, but it's more what can we do, I and God. Because apart from God, I can do nothing. But I can do all things through Him who gives me strength. So, with God's help, what can I do in those couple of areas to improve? And then if you improve a lot in those areas, and then you can pick another area that you are weak in and work on that. Because, you know, if you try to do too much at once, you just get overwhelmed and give up, don't you? So knock them off one or two at a time and work at it that way is what I would challenge you to do. But I'm sure we can all find something here to work on. And so I would challenge you to do that today. We'll ask the worship team to come forward in just a minute. And I want to just have a brief word of prayer with you before they come forward. As they come forward. Father in heaven, we've looked at what love is today. If we've been honest with ourselves, we realize that each of us falls short in some way. But the purpose of this is not to make us feel bad about ourselves, because that's not what you're all about. You don't seek to condemn us because you love us. You think the best of us. You believe in our potential, not in what we are right now. And so as we identify those areas in our life that you would have us to work on, I pray that each of us would truly seek your will, to seek your guidance in identifying which areas to focus on, to rely upon you for the help, for the strength, for the encouragement that we need, because we can't do this on our own. We can only do it through your help. Help us to be the kind of loving people that you want us to be. Help us to be the kind of loving people so that the world can see Christ in us. And we'll give you the praise in Jesus' name. Amen.